My name is Herb Behrens. I'm a volunteer at the National Steinbeck Center here in Salinas, California. I've been an archivist, or working as an archivist, volunteering as for about 10 years. I'm in the process of reorganizing the archives, so I get a chance to look at all the wonderful things that the National Steinbeck Center has acquired. The museum depicts the life, writings, and times of John Steinbeck. One of the fortunate things about John Steinbeck is that many of his works were made into movies, so we have a lot of library cards. We have a lot of clips from those films. One of the things about Of Mice and Men, that it is one of what John Steinbeck referred to as his play novels. In fact, it's the first one. The other one is The Moon is Down, and the third he considered Burning Bright. The play novel is that type of novel in which you can pick up and take it on stage. In fact, the very first production was not in New York, but in San Francisco, in the Green Theater, took copies of the book, if it had been published, and holding them in their hands, read the text as a play. This was an experimental type of group of people, and they did all sorts of different experimental plays in the 30s. So you managed the Craig Rice and other people who were doing these sort of experimental proletarian type plays. So
the 30s, that would have been very early in his writing career.
Right. Yeah, Of Mice and Men, he claims Of Mice and Men was the book that made him more money, or started to make the money for him. Previously, he had written and had been published and had received monies from a play, from a movie of Tortilla Flat. And Tortilla Flat was his way of putting the King Arthurian legend and story in the setting of Monterey.
Danny.
Yeah, Danny and the group there. And one of the things that happened was that after it became famous and people knew he was living in Pacific Grove at this case, why people came down to one to find out where Tortilla Flat was. Well, the city fathers said, no, there is no such place as Tortilla Flat. And, of course, there's always been speculation exactly, is Tortilla Flat a geographical location? Well, there are several Tortilla Flats. There are places where the paisanos actually lived, where the people lived, or other places that they congregated. Steinbeck, in one interview, was asked where it is, and he tapped his head like this. But it's really a gathering place, almost a state of mind, because people would comment about things that were going on, in Tortilla Flat, meaning where the paisanos and where those people were living. When Cannery Row came out, was published and appeared in when he was living in Monterey, why many of the critics just said, he just moved his paisanos down from the hills down to Cannery Row. And, of course, Cannery Row is a much, much deeper book than either Tortilla Flat or that many people see in it.
But a lot of the locals were outraged at him for that.
Yeah. Well, they were outraged because they weren't in it.
Right.
They wanted to be in. And, of course, as he did with almost all of his writings, I would say, except for maybe a Cup of Gold, the people in Cannery Row were people that he knew. Of course, the most famous being the Doc character.
Right.
And since then, Doc has been attached to the name Ricketts constantly, particularly in the newspaper accounts of the lab. It's always Doc Ricketts' lab, or Doc's lab, and for a long time it's been called that.
Can you address Steinbeck's early writing influences and experiences?
Well, I would say, from what I've read, that his early influences were the classics. The Bible, Pilgrim's Progress. His family had a very good library, which they had a lot of magazines. They were readers. There was no television, of course, then, no radio. So there we have pictures of the family sitting around reading. His mother had been a school teacher, she brought a sense of she was Irish, and she brought a sense of fairy tales. Or some of his early readings from his two older sisters to him were mythologies, legends, fairy tales, and things like that. So, and all through his life, he was a voracious reader. He had a huge library. One of the things that always surprised me and that he commented on was the size of the library that he had in Rocinante. It almost broke the axles because it was so heavy. Yeah. And he often yeah. And he often, and he had said one time that after the Bible and the Pilgrim's Progress and some of the classics, his favorite books was the Oxford English Dictionary. Because he was very interested in words.
Yes.
He was very interested in the right word and the rhythm of the words. And as we mentioned before, that I think that was one of the reasons that he used a dictaphone. And it was very late in his life that he used a dictaphone. But he would have these the old cylinders, and then he would give it to somebody to transcribe, of course. But he also said that, and he gave this as a advice to a young writer, I think Dennis Murphy, but I'm not positive, to the effect is that once you do some writing, sit back and read it out loud.
Wow.
And he used to read his stories out loud.
To all of his friends.
Yeah, to all of his friends.
At Stanford, bored the hell out of them.
Right, and even in in high school, well, he'd tell these wonderful stories. And that was his life, a very imaginative life. He was somewhat of a loner in the sense that he was literally by himself. He wasn't a joiner. As far as we know, he never went to dances or went on dates. The people that have been interviewed who knew him in high school said that he was okay in school. Some of them don't even remember him as a class president, although he was elected and stuff. His picture appears in the track team and basketball team, but most people don't think he was a very good player or runner. I think John was very careful. He was an introvert, I would say. He was very careful with how he was with people, with strangers. And I think he felt that he wasn't sure of himself. I don't think he was really, really positive about his writing all of his life. In reading his letters, he was very self-deprecating. And in fact, one of the things that always amazed me is he spends 2 or 3 months working on this wonderful book from his investigative reporting, which eventually becomes Grapes of Wrath. And there's the published diary called Working Days is available. And as you're reading this, you see what he's talking about, how he has to get the Jobes over the Tehachapi Mountains and things like that. But then at the very end, when he finishes the book, he says, "God, I hope it's good." I mean, you've read all the literature, some of the articles and the accolades, the Pulitzer Prize for this book, and here's this man.
And he said,
"I don't know whether this is a good book or not." And he tells Pat Covici, "Oh, just do about 5,000 copies."
The controversial ending to Grapes of Wrath, mm-hmm. the breastfeeding of mm-hmm. of what's his name in the boxcar. As I recall, was actually a story that Steinbeck had collected when he was working for the state of California. He would pay 25 cents to people for a good story.
That's what I understand also.
Irishman brought him this story.
And he had this wonderful memory that he would, so many of the Paisano stories came from Sue Gregory, from Hattie Craig, from things that he, when he had, was working with the workers there, when he was working for Spreckle Sugar Company here, just outside of Salinas.
His father was an engineer with him, or something.
No, his father was an accountant with him. His father was a manager of a flour mill,
right.
And then owned a feed store, and then toward the end of his life, he was the county treasurer. very respected. I mean, the family was very respected here. And so the ending to The Grapes of Wrath got a lot of people in trouble. It got John in trouble because the publisher didn't want to do it that way. In fact, Elizabeth Otis, his agent, came out to California when they were living in Los Gatos to, in a kind of check on and censor some of the language that he used. And and in one of his letters he wrote, he says, "I'm not writing for social club ladies. This is the way workers talk." And he was writing the vernacular in the dialect that he had heard. But I had heard that story too, that he had bought this 2 or 3 or 4 years before he even started working on Grapes of Wrath.
Right.
And I think he not only collected stories, he collected, he knew people. And he says in one of his interviews, when interviewing about Of Mice and Men, he was saying, yeah, the character of Lenny is someone I knew. And he describes this person who ran a pitchfork through the foreman's stomach because the foreman had fired this guy's friend. And he says, well, he's in the state mental institution now. Now, my feeling with John Steinbeck in interviews is that you have to be a little careful. Because sometimes, I mean, he's telling a great story in a lot of times. And I think a lot of what he's storing, and I think with this, in this case about the story of who Lenny was, is that these were true. But he was very, he did not like to talk about himself. And in fact, one of his interviews, he said, "I would rather people, I don't care what they say about my books. I do care what they think about my books." He would be approached in wherever he was. He was good copy because he had he had a lot of interesting, pithy things to say.
He won Pulitzer, Nobel Prize, an Oscar.
Yeah.
I mean, the list of the presidential awards.
Yes.
Yeah. Is no one's
and
ever...
three Commonwealth Club Awards. In fact, they at the end of the third one, they put in a rule at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco that no author would get three. because he got one for, I think, In Dubious Battle, Cup of Gold, and The Mice and Men. I think those were the ones that he had.
Incredible.
Yeah, he was good copy because he felt very comfortable. But he was not someone who felt that he, John Steinbeck, should be the object of this interview. His story should be his, what he's writing, what he thinks about things. So when the publisher early on in his career asked him to send, biography, why he said, "I've told so many lies, I don't know where to start," or words to that effect.
I was just reading, finished reading the Steve Jobs biography, and was introduced to the concept of reality distortion. And I realized that this is something that's really prevalent amongst creative people, is the ability to make the reality a plastic commodity that can be bent to will or desire or fantasy or whatever, and be just as real.
Well, one of the interesting things that's recently come out, there's been a investigative reporter, a former reporter from Boston, called Bill Seigerwald. And Bill Seigerwald did what John Steinbeck did. He took a trip and followed it as closely as possible. And what Bill Seigerwald has found out, that a lot of the places that Steinbeck said he was at, he wasn't. A lot of the people that he met, he did not. They were composites. And a lot of the things that happened to Steinbeck that do not appear in the book, for example, the times and the occasions when he was visited by Elaine, and how many times
we're talking
he
travels with Charlie.
Travels with Charlie, yes, I'm sorry. Right. And in Travels with Charlie, Bill Seigerwald thinks or makes the comment that he feels the publisher's misleading the public by first placing it under nonfiction. Secondly, giving you the impression that maybe Steinbeck giving you the impression that he was roughing it. And Seigerwald, in going through the letters some of which are at Stanford Library, and the original manuscript, which is at the J.P. Morgan Library, he's able to show all the places and all the ways that Steinbeck twisted reality. I think the timeline, when he left Sag Harbor and when he came back, that's pretty well definite. It's when he's writing a letter where he says in the novel or in the book, I'm at such and such, and it turns out that he had written and mailed a letter from a place 150 miles away, or the fact he never mentions that when he's coming down from the Pacific Northwest to San Francisco that Elaine is with him.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a lot of things about it that he gets here in Monterey, and he visits some of his relatives, and he goes through here. He doesn't mention the fact that when he left Salinas, supposedly, when he left Salinas, he has his lawyer, Webster Street, with him. Webster Street tells a story about how the two of them went from Monterey, Pacific Grove, all the way into Arizona, where Webster Street then left and came back. He doesn't mention that at all. And I don't know that there's really any reason to in this particular case. Mm-hmm. He talks about him another way. And this got a bit of a furor. Susan Schillinglaw, one of the Steinbeck scholars here, was kind of upset and said, well, this is not uncommon. Writers do this, and it doesn't detract. And I don't think it does. I don't think it detracts from the beauty of the story or the amusement or the entertainment of it. Just because when you read it, and this was brought out by other reviewers, that they thought, well, this is kind of strange that he happens to meet three men, three hitchhikers, have a left, a middle, and a right view of the black situation after he has just come from New Orleans. Isn't that convenient? You know? But I think what he's expressing in these is a universal truth about what he did and what happened. And then when he writes his final work, American Americas, he expands on a lot of his views about America. And here he's writing a history, in a sense, of the United States, its dreams, the history of it, some of the things that happened to him, the bigotry that he was involved with as well. And it's interesting that when he was told about this assignment that one of his publishers wanted him to do, it turned out that the publisher wanted to write captions for a few of these photographs. You know, caption one, two, maybe three lines or something like that. Well, Steinbeck, in his way, started writing, and it came out with this wonderful book of not very, really very, very deep, but what I think very interesting history. I mean, the man had an amazing knowledge of history, and he knew things, and I think that's one of the other things that attracted him to the King Arthur stories, that besides wanting to translate the Old English and the Mallory book into contemporary English, he was very interested in the life, not only the life of the King Arthur character, but also the life of Mallory. Who was Mallory? And so that's one of the reasons he went into the Vatican Library to see if he could find information on where he spent so much time in Somerset and in England, and which was a wonderful time for him and Elaine. But he's I think, a very interesting, complex, contradictory, complicated man.
Can you talk about, or do you know of any examples of his working with young writers or giving advice to young writers?
Yes, one of the ones that I know of specifically, because he writes so well about him, is a man named Dennis Murphy. Dennis Murphy was the grandson of Dr. Murphy, who was the Steinbeck family doctor, who saved Steinbeck's life when he was quite ill with pleural pneumonia, and who delivered probably all the Steinbecks, and may have been the resident Steinbeck resident doctor when Steinbeck's mother and father were ill and dying. Dennis Murphy. There's a wonderful letter in the collection of letters, Steinbeck, A Life and Letters, in which Steinbeck writes to to John Murphy, Dennis Murphy's father, mother, and says to the effect of, "I'm sorry, you have a writer, and you're going to have to live with this persona, you know, for the rest of your life. That this is the writer that's going to act in a very strange way." And Dennis Murphy's first book, and apparently his most successful book, was a book called The Sergeant. And it was later made into a movie with Rod Steiger. Steinbeck was also involved with writers in the sense that he would, apparently he would give them encouragement. He wouldn't give them advice. I don't think he felt competent enough to say, "Well, you should have written your story such and such." I think he encouraged them, as he told Dennis Murphy, he says, "Writing is your best revenge." When you know, when Dennis Murphy was getting bad reviews and people were giving him hell and that sort of thing. He was involved with a writer's program in Los Angeles that Bud Schulberg was involved with. In fact, there's a wonderful article that Bud Schulberg wrote after Steinbeck's death. Bud Schulberg had been in New York and learned that Steinbeck was in the hospital. And this was in 67 when Steinbeck was ill after having a back operation and several strokes. And they talk in this, and Bud Schulberg writes this about, I think the title of it is "A Lion in His Winter," is the title of the article that Bud Schulberg writes. And Steinbeck apparently had encouraged not only verbally and in writing, but also financially, this group of writers in Los Angeles that Bud Schulberg was involved with, young writers. And they had done a collection of their short stories and had given it to John, and John was quite happy about it. And Schulberg was impressed with this, as he referred to this, Craig-faced man who was medicated and still drinking. I get the feeling. And then when he was in Russia, when he and Elaine went to Russia, he specifically spoke and wrote to the writers' guild and writers' organizations there, back and forth. And we have pictures of him standing in front of, giving a lecture, which is very, very strange for Steinbeck to do.
During Stalin's time,
I think you're right. Yeah, or certainly, if not Stalin, at least Khrushchev. There was certainly that era of repression,
right,
that wasn't as free as there may be now. But I think, and I'm sure he got bombarded. In fact, he writes this wonderful letter. He was a contributing editor of the Saturday Review, and he wrote this wonderful article addressed to school teachers saying, teachers, please stop telling your students to write to me because he's getting these letters from students, you know, writing saying, my teacher told me to write to you and ask you about whatever the pearl or the red pony or whatever
right,
it is.
Right.
Or if I don't get an answer from you about this question, I'm going to flunk the class. And so he had all these wonderful, examples of how he's being inundated, and I'm sure he was. People would send him books asking him to not only, "I think you should read my book," or "Will you please autograph this copy of such and such?" And I think in most cases he did. He wrote an interesting article in which he mentions about all the people who would write to him and say, "Now look, I have this wonderful idea. Uh-huh. Now you're a writer. Now, I got this great A. I'm sure we can make a million. I'll give you half," you know. And he'd go on and say, and these people would tell him these wonderful ideas, and they he referred to some of them as almost being belligerent if he wouldn't accept it. You know, why can't you see the worth of what I'm going to write,
almost
what I want you to write?
All of the writers that we've interviewed have told that same story about as soon as they announce that they're a writer or their name gets out.
Yeah,
they're
right.
"I have the best idea for the best novel."
Yeah, right, yeah. Or an incident happened. "You wouldn't believe what happened to me in this bar," or whatever, you know,
right,
something like that.
Yeah. Can you tell us where Charlie is buried?
Yes, Charlie is buried at the family home under a tree in Sag Harbor. And trying to think of the date in which he died. I can't. I think it's 66, but I'm not positive. Steinbeck, in one of his letters, tells the story that he's buried there. They put him under the tree, and they go to town to do some chores, some errands, and they come back, and here all these flowers are planted under. Now, I'd like to think that somebody knew Charlie was buried there, and that's the flowers. I mean, he leaves it that way, too. He talks about Charlie's last days, as far as he knows, is he just died of old age. He was not a drinker, so it couldn't be cirrhosis of the liver or something like that. It's a very, very touching thing, and I think that's one of the things that makes Travels with Charlie so nice, so interesting.
Could you just talk about, for a moment, your knowledge of Steinbeck and technology, the technologies of writing or storytelling or crafting?
No. But I can tell you what others have said and he has said. One of the best books that I know of how Steinbeck wrote or what he thought about writing is the letters that he wrote to Pascal Covici while he was writing East of Eden, and those have been reprinted in a book called Journal of a Novel. And in it, he was writing on one side of his huge ledger the novel Salinas Valley. The one time was the title of it. The other side, he was writing letters in the form letters to Pascal Covici, his editor at Viking, in the form of a almost like a diary. Well, and he comments on this, but the ironic thing is that Covici will never see these letters until after the manuscript is given to him. In other words, Covici came to Sag Harbor and other places, picked up the manuscript. It was torn between the manuscript here and the letters over here. And after the manuscript was there and the page proofs were done and things like that, then the letters were published. As far as I can remember, they weren't published in Steinbeck's time. He wasn't alive when they were doing. But Steinbeck writes about how to write. But he writes it in such a way so that you do not really see. He says, well, I'm going to have to do this, or I'm going to give you a point of view, Pascal or Pat, that you won't see it until two or three chapters down of what I'm doing. It's really, for me, an interesting way of seeing how a man or a writer will go into and describe a certain thing. It's a little bit like, for me, it's a little bit like reading Shakespeare's plays. You get the play, and then you get exits severally in all directions or something like that. Then you go to the theater, and you see the way the stage business, what has happened, where the people are standing, how they're reacting, that you don't get in the printed page. And so it's a little bit... You read something, and then you read it again, and you read it again in Steinbeck, and you get a lot of different things.
And in both cases of Shakespeare and Steinbeck, you also get the music of the words in your ear.
Yeah, that's what he liked.
Yeah.
And the interesting things about music is that when he says in his diary working days while he's working on The Grapes of Wrath that he's listening to classical music, Dvorak's New World Symphony. He talks about Tchaikovsky. He doesn't mention listening to music other times, though. That's the only time that I can remember that he mentions it. He talks about how the novel is set like a symphony with the movements and things like that. So. It's as I said at the beginning, I find John very complex, complicated.
Herb, this has been fantastic. I mean, not only just your wealth of knowledge, but just the chance to even be in the Zoom with Rosamonte, and you have been amazing.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of anybody who happens to watch this, I know they'll want to thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. As you can tell, I like to talk.
You've got the gift to gab.